You're listening to Central Time. I'm Veronica Rickert. Rob Ferret is out today. From the days of Occupy Wall Street to the Bernie Sanders presidential campaign, there's been a lot of attention paid to income equality in the United States and the divisions between the top 1% and everybody else. Our next guest says we should also be paying attention to income equality among cities around the country and regions. He writes that there's been a big shift where incomes between cities like New York and San Francisco and Milwaukee were getting closer and closer to one another until around 1980. In the last couple decades, they've been growing farther and farther apart with big winners and big losers. And he says there are some fundamental policy decisions that are behind that change. Philip Longman joins us now. He's policy director and managing editor of the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation. And his piece on the growing economic divide between American cities is linked on the Central Time Facebook page. Philip, welcome to the show.
Good to be here, Veronica. Thanks for having me.
Well, you write that for a long time, American cities were converging incomes, that is, were getting closer together from about 1940 to 1980. Can you paint us a picture of what was going on then in cities around the country?
Actually, this trend goes back even farther beyond 1940, that gradually the different regions of America grew closer and closer in their standards of living. So partly this is a story of the South gradually catching up with the North in its level of industrial development, but it was also a story of the Plain States and the Mountain West catching up with the East Coast. So if we follow this trend to its climax, sometime in the late 60s, the per capita income of Cedar Rapids, Iowa, for example, was basically the same as that of the New York metropolitan area. Milwaukee, Rockford, Illinois, these were cities that had per capita incomes that were within shouting distance of the per capita income of cities like Boston, New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco. And there were many different reasons we can talk about why those incomes were converging towards what came to be known as the single American standard of living. But since about 1980, those trends have been pushed into reverse. And so now almost all of the gains in wealth and income that we see in the country as a whole are concentrated in a few elite cities.
And what does that spread look like today?
Well, the picture we see today is one in which a few elite cities, Washington, D.C., New York, Boston, San Francisco, Seattle, are pulling farther and farther away from the rest of America. Certainly what's come to be known as flyover America, the great Midland heartland of America. It's once major cities like St. Louis, Cincinnati, Milwaukee, are falling farther and farther behind their per capita income as compared to, say, New York. But some people would say, well, that's just because those are Rust Belt cities. They have a declining manufacturing base and like that. But it's also true if you look at the supposedly vibrant Sun Belt cities like Atlanta or even Houston at the height of the oil boom was falling farther and farther behind San Francisco, New York, Boston, Washington. So that's the new face of regional inequality in America, and it turns out that much of the inequality between the 1% and all the rest actually deconstructs to a regional inequality growing up between these elite coastal cities and flyover America.
So why should that matter to us, that beyond this, the 1% in individuals, that they're also located within particular cities? Why does that matter?
Well, it certainly matters if we have shared prosperity. So if you happen to be in one of these cities that is not participating in the growth of the country, life is getting increasingly uncomfortable. And I think it's also politically dangerous. We had generations and generations of Americans before us who worked very, very hard to close the gaps between the different regions of the country so that there would be a single American standard of living and so that we would not be set against each other sectionally as we once were in the Civil War, for example, right? And so it's also when you get into it and you look at the particular reasons why these few cities are doing so much better than the rest of the country, they're not particularly noble reasons. They're reasons that have to do with what economists often call rent-seeking. That is, in New York's case, it's largely built on financial speculation and manipulation. In the case of San Francisco, it's increasingly Bay Area, increasingly based on patent monopolies and other things that aren't actually creating wealth, but rearranging wealth.
We're talking with Philip Longman right now from the New America Foundation, talking about his recent piece on income inequality among American cities. And he says that there are haves and have-nots in different parts of the country, but it has not always been that way. And Philip, you say there are some major public policy decisions at work here and that laws relating to monopolies were a big part of that picture. But for starters, how did things used to work in a time when incomes were coming closer together and we had that one American standard of living that was emerging?
Well, going back to the 19th century, one thing that our previous generations of Americans were very sure to make happen was that they wanted to equalize the access and pricing of transportation throughout the continent. So as railroads came into being a major source of transportation, one of the things that first became a big problem with railroads is that they tended to engage in price discrimination between different regions of the country. So out in Wisconsin, particularly 100 years ago, they had a gigantic movement of farmers and people associated with agriculture who realized that they were completely at the mercy of mostly Eastern-owned railroads, and that these railroads engaged in price discrimination in ways that meant that folks in the Midwest were competing not on the basis of who could produce the best grain or the best manufacturing items, but on who had the best access to favorable freight railroad rates. And so, you know, we set up an institution known as the Interstate Commerce Commission as early as 1887 that basically controlled the prices and equalized the prices of everything that moved in the United States across state lines. And most states had their own versions of that to control it within state lines. And that system lasted up and through the early 1980s. And as new technologies like airlines came along, we applied the same standard to airlines, which meant that back in the 60s or 70s, right, the level of service that a city like Milwaukee would experience airline service was not fundamentally different than that of any other city, and that the pricing was equalized. Today, of course, we've deregulated airlines, and we've deregulated trucks, and we've deregulated everything that moves, basically. And what that means is both the pricing and the level of service on airlines, for example, is vastly different from one city to another. And mostly what it means is that the mid-sized cities of America, in sort of flyover America, basically don't have the connectivity to the rest of the country and the rest of the global economy that they need to, for example, be a viable headquarters for a Fortune 500 company. You know, we've seen Fortune 500 companies moving out of places like Cincinnati simply because air service has deteriorated so much. That's the kind of thing that public policy, going back to the railroad era, you know, made very sure didn't happen, but is happening now again. It's happening in railroads and freight rates on railroads, which matter a lot to grain shippers in the Midwest. They now find themselves living in a world that predates 1887 in terms of its level of laissez-faire. And we have, you know, single railroads like the Burlington Northern Santa Fe, you know, basically controlling vast swaths of the rail infrastructure on monopolistic terms. So these things, too, tend to push us towards greater regional inequality.
Now, you write that change started to happen in the Carter administration. What happened then?
Well, in the 70s, it was an era of high inflation, and many liberals were very concerned that inflation was, you know, a serious problem for which liberalism was largely being blamed at the time. and looked around for solutions. And unfortunately, a lot of people at that era forgot why some of these policies that had been put in place, you know, going back to the mid-19th century, what their ultimate rationale was and why they were still needed. And so I think, especially in the case of airline deregulation, it was people were thinking, well, if we deregulate it, we'll get cheaper prices. And we desperately need cheaper prices because we're living in this era of terrible inflation. And the first order effect of that deregulation was cheaper prices. But, you know, two mistakes were made. One is they forgot that with deregulation, you minimally had to have very strong antitrust enforcement, or all the airlines would eventually merge with one another and engage in monopolistic prices. And that's essentially what has happened now. We're now in an era, in a world in which there's only four major carriers left in the United States, and most cities, even large cities, are captive to only one of them, which means that whether they rise or fall in the world depends on the contingencies like how some particular airline decides to price its tickets and what kind of service it decides to offer. And so previous generations of Americans would just never stand for that. They would say, no, that's a public decision. We want the economy, we want market structured so that people are competing on the basis of things other than who happens to have favorable access to transportation costs.
We're talking to Philip Longman right now from the New America Foundation, talking about his recent piece on income inequality among American cities. And you can join our conversation at 800-642-1234. Do you agree with this, that there is more income inequality among American cities, among regions of the country? And what do you think needs to be done, if you think anything needs to be done? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. We continue our conversation now with Philip Longman with the New America Foundation, and he says we should be paying more attention to a growing income gap among American cities and making policy changes so that we don't turn into a nation of regional haves and have-nots. And you can join us at 800-642-1234. Why do you think some cities and regions are booming while others have been on the decline? Do you think this is a problem that needs a solution? And do you think there's a national solution, or is it up to state and local governments to deal with their own economies? How do you see Milwaukee and other cities around Wisconsin fitting into the national economic landscape? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page. And Philip, is there any indication with the Founding Fathers about their intent when it comes to income distribution around the country?
Well, the Constitution itself sets up a Senate and a House, which that can be looked at, particularly the Senate, as a way of giving disproportionate influence to the rural areas and underpopulated areas of America to make sure that they have a voice in national affairs. And the post office, a lot of people don't realize it, but the Postal Service is actually written into the Constitution. The Founding Fathers understood that they couldn't rely on a private company to deliver equal levels of service at equal prices when it came to delivering the mail across the continent. So they made it a constitutional requirement of government that kind of equalization of services be provided. They also, if you go back, From basically 1980 all the way back to the founding of the country, and even farther before that, right? There were various common laws in place that prevented the emergence of entities of anything like the scale of, say, Walmart or Amazon. You know, those of us a certain age can remember in the 1960s they had supermarkets. Some of them had names like the Atlantic and Pacific Tea Company, the old AMP, for people who remember that. But, you know, federal policy made sure that in any given market, no grocery chain or chain store of any kind would have more than 7 or 8% of the market share, because people understood the importance of local economies and keeping the money in circulation locally, not having it all siphoned off to distant headquarters cities. So we had modernization of retailing, but nothing like Walmart, and that worked. Those laws began to be dismantled in the 1970s, and the result now is that most economies are effectively colonized. Most of the economic decisions that happen in most communities in America aren't made in those communities. Most of the money spent in those communities ultimately leaves those communities. It's spent at Walmart and goes somewhere else, right? It's spent at Amazon, goes somewhere else.
And I want to jump in so we can get a caller in on this. We've got Majid joining us in Chicago. Majid, hello.
Yeah, hi there. Excellent show. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
It really very knowledgeable, and it teaches a lot. Okay, I would like to basically pronounce myself as a Muslim socialist, which is a very rare combination, by the way. You don't run across too many Muslim socialists these days. But my comment relating to your excellent show for today is that it is absolutely the job of the federal government to make sure that the entire land is fair and equitable, and no one has any particular monopoly or advantage or disadvantage in this whole big equation of ours called U.S. of A. So, yes, it is upon the federal government responsibilities, I think, to make it all good, equitable, and, you know, equal playing field.
Thank you so much for your comment. Appreciate that, Majid. And so here we are now with these income disparities among cities. Is it the responsibility of the federal government? If we want to change this, where do we turn from here, Philip?
Well, I think it is the responsibility of the federal government to help structure markets in ways that they do not become monopolized. And this is not some radical socialist idea. This is an all-American idea that goes back at least to the 1830s, and the Sherman Antitrust Act was passed in 1890, so there's nothing new or radical about it. Ironically, the so-called laissez-faire policies of the 19th century involved a lot more direct, hands-on government control than we have today. In terms of, like as I was explaining earlier, you know, directly setting prices in transportation, directly intervening in mergers to make sure that regional economies weren't surpassed. Some people think that there's some inevitability, some technological inevitability to all this. This is brought to you by the digitalization of the economy or the globalization of the economy. But one of the things I like to remind people of is when the internet was still brand new and futurists were trying to guess what would be the effect of having this new technology that would allow anybody to communicate with anybody anywhere in the world anytime for free, right? What would be the effect? And everybody predicted that it would be, as they put it at the time, the death of distance, right? It would mean that it would no longer matter, you know, whether you were in downtown Manhattan, New York, or you were in a tree hut in Oregon. You would have equal access to the world economy. And in a purely technological sense, we do have that, right? Technology has amazingly democratized access geographically, and yet we see that the effect is to have the where you live be all and more determinative of how you do. So it's not something that's happening because of technology. It's something that's happening despite technology, which shows you how much is being brought to you by other forces.
Now, Philip, we've just got a couple of moments left here. How hopeful are you that this will become part of the conversation among policymakers?
Well, I'm very hopeful because I think all it takes is for it to be pointed out to folks, and they instantly recognize it as something that's true. I'm also hopeful because previous generations of Americans knew how to deal with this problem and did deal with it and successfully wrestled it to the ground, to the point by the late 60s we had basically no regional inequality in the United States anymore. So they could do it, we could do it. It took them, you know, many, many decades to get it done. It won't happen for us overnight, but it's not like we have to invent something that's never been invented.
And Philip, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
That was Philip Longman, Policy Director and Managing Editor of the Open Markets Program at the New America Foundation.